my main response to the world is not one of anger. As I get older, I find it's one of disappointment. One of disappointment.
I was so disappointed by the events of the day.
Everybody will be so disappointed.
To series 2 of So Disappointed, the podcast that asks you about some of the things that have really let you down. Disappointment comes in so many forms. Maybe you've been disappointed by a film or television franchise, an artist you admire, a political figure, an ideology, or just the human race in general. The permutations are endless. We'll be looking at why we get so invested in people and things to such an extent that we get angry when they let us down. Why do we care? What's wrong with us? What's wrong with them? In this episode, we'll be looking at what may well be the greatest, most crushing disappointment of all. The future. You remember the future. That exciting, shiny utopia we children of the past were led to believe was just around the corner. A world not just full of positively life-changing technological advancements, but also one in which all forms of prejudice and inequality had been erased once and for all. You know, the Star Trek universe and its vast, infinite possibilities. A future worth believing in. Sure, we also grew up with dire dystopian warnings of what might transpire, warnings based on the cyclical horror of human history, but I think it's fair to say, naive though it may sound, that maybe, just maybe, the human race would have learned from its mistakes by now. But the actual now? As we look around us, here, in the future, in this brave new world, what do we find? We find a planet ravaged by human-made climate change, a spiralling cinder governed by fascist dictators and Sikh-hiling billionaire tech bros pushing corrosive AI slop that nobody asked for. A profoundly dangerous elite of far-right extremists, white supremacists and genocide deniers who control the narrative. An evil cabal of unconscionable grifters, spreading outright lies and disinformation without ever being held to account by a compliant mainstream media. Hatred isn't punished, it's celebrated these days. Bigotry is reframed as legitimate concerns. Violent racist riots are reported as protests, while actual peaceful protests for progressive causes are either misrepresented or completely ignored. This is, as Basil Fawlty once spluttered, exactly how Nazi Germany started. And God help us all if we're looking to Basil Fawlty as a voice of reason. We live in horrifying times, my darlings. Society hasn't soared into an enlightened golden age. It's regressed. Things just get worse and worse. But there has to be some hope, right? The future is now. It's all we have. Whatever happened to it, though? And how did we get here? With a very heavy and yet hopeful heart, let's attempt to find out.
Hi, I think history's merciless. And it only goes one way. Onwards. It marches on and on and on. And what if this never swings back? What if Trump just keeps on winning forever and ever? How far will it go? How much will they hate us? Because they hate us, Leo. They really hate us. And you know what? I think they've always hated us. Only now they don't have to pretend anymore. No. History tells us one thing. That blood and fire and retribution always happen. And right now, it's coming for us.
We'll begin with So Disappointed's resident psychologist David Myers, who's been looking into some of the reason behind our malaise. David, we all grew up in a world where there was this utopian vision of the future. It was fed to us daily on television and in films, but that appears to have stopped, certainly within the last 15 years or so. So what's happened? Why do we no longer believe in it?
So I guess that from that, the question is, did anybody really believe that by this time we'd all be in flying cars and holidaying at centre parks on the moon? I don't know. If they did, psychologically, they'd probably be people who would score really highly in openness in terms of personality and fairly lowly in terms of neuroticism. So they wouldn't be really suspicious of anything that was offered to them. Very open to new ideas, creative thinkers, etc. However, people with that sort of personality structure aren't as likely to be disappointed when that future doesn't arrive because they pivot. They have that ability to think a lot more flexibly and a lot more adaptably than other people. So they would adapt to their circumstances. I guess people with those sort of modes of thought would probably be quite entrepreneurial in their approach and would maybe be a bit more driven than your average human being, if you like. Secondly, and this has nothing to do with psychology really, the reasons why that model of the future hasn't happened are probably down to economics. Technological progress is really expensive. And certainly since 2008 in the West, since the big financial crisis, there's not been any economic growth. There's not been any money. I suspect if people are disappointed by the future not arriving yet, it's probably just one aspect of a more general sense of disappointment for those people. Yeah. And what on earth has happened to the world and what's going on.
House prices for our parents in the 1970s, 50 years ago, were on average 3 to 4 times the average salary, and petrol cost 17 pence a litre. Can you imagine? The last time I was at a petrol station, it was £1.78 per litre. It was extortionate. And for us to buy a house now in 2026, houses are generally 8 to 9 times the average wage. So it's beyond most people. It's beyond most people to even get that kind of deposit that they would need to buy a house. So perhaps people these days are looking more at the problems of now than looking forward to some kind of hopeful future. Are we mired in the present?
In a lot of ways, yes. When I was in my early to mid-20s, so around the year 2000 to 2003, I noticed what seemed like a climate of fear being stoked by the government. Mm-hmm. First of all, it was to do with issues around crime. Mm-hmm. So it was stuff that's very, very immediate to you, potentially. Then the threat of terrorism. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's necessarily a new thing, because I know that people were afraid of nuclear war in the 50s and 60s. But that was always closely related to really specific events which were happening, mm-hmm. and those crises were averted. But it was still a clear and present danger to people at that point, even if it was unlikely. Mm-hmm. Even if there is a real climate of fear, the irony is that we've never been so safe. So crime is historically low, life expectancy is historically high, But what has changed is we've got the 24-hour news cycle. There's an aspect of kind of therapy culture having been imported from the States, and kind of running along those things, the impact of social media and just the kind of wider sociocultural and economic uncertainty that's going on in the world at the moment. You know, as we spoke about, everything is really expensive. There's wars going on. House prices are through the roof. Food inflation is through the roof. People's pay isn't keeping up with that. So there's a lot of people's concerns are naturally going to be driven much more close to home. So yes, they'll be thinking about themselves and their own situations more readily than they would be about, oh, well, what's coming down the line. But just in terms of people feeling afraid, there's a lot of strong research evidence to show significantly poorer mental health outcomes across the board, but most markedly among teenagers and young adults since the period of about 2011 to 2016. So in parallel to that, the majority of 16 to 25-year-olds are frightened of the future, and that strongly correlates with their anxiety over climate change. Those were two findings from, I think, 2021 in a study that was published in The Lancet. Mm-hmm. So if the thing that we have to be afraid of is the climate and, by extension, the future itself, mm-hmm. who would want the future to actually happen?
I genuinely think this is what's happened. Speaking to Generation Z, as I do often, our childhood visions of the future tended to be utopian, whereas their visions of the future tend to be dystopian. Their computer games, their films, tend to be based around a future that takes place after the collapse of society. Thinking about the Pixar film WALL-E, which was a huge hit when that generation were children, that was their cartoon, that was their Bambi or Snow White. And it's basically a film about us destroying the planet and humanity and having to live in space and losing all quality of life. That's kind of what they've grown up with. So the future does not look bright for these kids. The future they're seeing is rising sea levels, rising temperatures. We're already experiencing that. So is it that they don't want to think about the future in a positive way?
Potentially, yes. It sort of touches on the issue of trust as well. Mm-hmm. So when I was doing some research, I noticed that the 2026 Edelman Trust Barometer was published in January. And that was some of the findings. I found some of the findings from last year's report was what I cited in our episode about aliens. This year's report has found that compared to 2025, 44% of the public in the UK trust businesses, government, the media, NGOs, etc., which is only a point up on last year, which isn't a statistically significant change. So that's less than half of the public trust our institutions. And the great thing about the Edelman Trust Barometer is it happens worldwide in samples of over 1,000 people. So the actual sample itself is something like 35,000 participants. So the statistics you get out of it are fantastic. So there's a lot of variation between levels of trust across the whole sample of countries. Overall, trust went from a rating of 56% to 57%, but it's the developing countries in the sample where trust is increasing on average. In the West, it's generally stagnant or falling slightly. That's important because governments and industry would be the drivers of change, which would bring about whatever the future looks like. So if we don't believe in them as institutions, we're not likely to believe that they're going to bring it about.
And if we don't believe that they're going to bring it about, then the people creating the stories, the creative people, are not going to be writing about a positive future.
No, absolutely not. A really good example, though, was pointed out in the report where there has been a recent significant technological development in the form of AI. Mm-hmm. So things like ChatGPT, Gemini, etc. This was nowhere a couple of years ago. And now you can't open a website without a little AI chatbot popping up. I think it's really annoying. But I'm old. So the survey found that the majority of people, so across the whole sample, in the low-income bracket, so 54%, think that they're more likely to be left behind than realise any real advantages from generative AI. The UK was where participants were particularly pessimistic. 71% of people on low incomes and 60% of middle-income earners felt that way about AI.
Wow.
Which is really significant. About a third of those on high incomes had the same concern.
That's huge, David.
That's it is huge.
Because AI is what we are being told is the future. And unfortunately, what we're discovering is that it's not necessarily just to place this episode in time. The last couple of days, everybody's discovered that if you were to Google the word cancel or the word disregard, then their AI feature will not give you the definition of that word. It will come up and say, okay, I won't do anything.
Oh.
I know. So if I wanted to know the exact definition of the word disregard, Google's AI will think that I have told it to disregard what I'm doing and simply go, okay, I won't do that. Which just makes me feel like I'm talking to Hal.
That's bizarre.
It is, isn't it? Isn't it? And of course, I'm very much part of a creative community. And the creative community is terrified of AI because AI cannot create anything new. It can only give you a mashup of what's existed before. And the conversation that's going around that is that AI then gives people with enough money to have, you know, access to, you know, people who pay for ChatGPT on a monthly basis. Mm-hmm. It gives those people access to skills that they don't have, i.e. creating graphics, creating animation, creating film, that they wouldn't previously have. But what that then does is it takes that money away from the people who could create that. So people who work in animation, people who work in illustration, graphics, etc., are losing jobs at an enormous rate because people can just create or just ask, prompt AI, Gemini, Claude, to give them something that previously they would have paid for. And so I can completely understand why we really don't trust that.
And time now for a visitation from our resident film critic, Eddie Harrison, who has thoughts on some of the hopes, dreams, and spectacularly inaccurate predictions we've been fed by cinema over the years.
We were in a generation whereby we always knew that we were going to live through the year 2000, as coined by Paul Pinder song. And we kind of knew that this was like, it wasn't just like the end of a decade, which lots of people lived through, but the end of a century, which a lot of people, and actually, you know, more than that, this was actually going to be the end of, you know, a whole period of time, the millennium, and we were going to live through it. And you could, you know, forgive us for getting into what they call these kind of visionary fin de siècle, you know, the kind of the end of the century, these kind of visionary things. So you might look back and think of Robert Louis Stevenson's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, or you might look back in H.G. Wells and see these things that are round about the cusp of the changing century. And so, you know, we were part of that generation. So we liked sci-fi and we were kind of forward looking and into the future. And, you know, if things had changed so much to get to this point, surely things were just going to keep changing. And yet I remember even as a kid, like kind of noticing, okay, so we got video recorders. video recorders were cool. Like that changed the way that you talk, watch TV. But this wasn't like a flying car. This wasn't the kind of stuff that we had been led to believe. This wasn't like a android that you could have sex with or something like that. None of these things were seemingly, on the cards. It was more just about, oh yeah, there's an extra little technical, thing to be added on to the thing that already exists, and you're kind of like, okay, this doesn't really feel like an incredible race into another world.
In the course of my work, which takes me to just about every corner of the globe, I see many aspects of a phenomenon which I'm just beginning to understand. Our modern technology has achieved a degree of sophistication beyond our wildest dreams, but this technology has exacted a pretty heavy price. We live in an age of anxiety, a time of stress, and with all our sophistication, we are in fact the victims of our own technological strength. We are the victims of shock, of future shock.
So, I was kind of thinking about what the films that kind of capture kind of wrong-headed futurism or backwards futurism maybe. And there's an Orson Welles, it's not written by him, I don't know what it is, I don't know what his relationship to it. It's based on a book by called Future Shock by Alvin Toffler, and they made this kind of 50-minute film called Future Shock, in which Orson Welles kind of talks about his kind of fears and anxieties and hopes and dreams for the future, although he's just reading through a script that somebody's written for him and he doesn't really seem to care. But he's warning us about androids, about AI. He's warning us about that, we will probably one day have kind of jack plugs in the back of our head that kind of plug us directly into the matrix. And it's one of these kind of predictions where he's kind of got the right idea, but the wrong execution of it. Because, yeah, people in the past would be horrified by the way that we move from screen to screen now. I wake up and I look at my small screen, and then I walk into another room where I put switch on a bigger screen and then also switch on a smaller screen. And then I might go to a work where I sit in front of a ginormous screen and then I come home. And that is a kind of new kind of thing that didn't exist, like in the 70s, people didn't live quite like that. They might have had a TV at home, but they might have had a little computer of some kind at work, but they didn't have that kind of absolute dependence where we find it hard to imagine life without Wi-Fi. So they kind of predict these things, but Orson Welles obviously can't imagine is Wi-Fi or the fact that we actually don't need jack plugs because we're going to be on the cloud. So it's kind of like this business of trying to predict what the future is going to be like is a kind of treacherous business because things look fairly kind of ridiculous when you actually, try and guess what it's going to be like.
A computer composite of 183 serial killers.
You see, in your world, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away, but in my world, killing it is a real rush.
I have to shut you down.
I will not be shut down.
But now, he's leaving the virtual world for hours.
Welcome to the real world.
I think I'm gonna like it.
And the other film that kind of sprang to mind, which is it's an older movie, but I genuinely had not seen this, and I found out why I had not seen it. It's called Virtuosity, and it was made by the guy who made The Lawnmower Man, which is a really, I think, interesting movie, as is its sequel, Lawnmower 2, because it's like imagining the internet again at this, fin de siècle period where we're just kind of like trying to guess what is the future going to be like. And I remember, going down to London and a friend of mine who worked for a tech company saying, you get your email and stuff like that through a thin pipe. One day it's going to be a fat pipe and everything is going to come through it. Movies, all your communication, everything that you do, and this thing is going to be on 24/7 all the day long, and you are going to live through this thing. And that kind of anxiety was kind of what The Lawnmower Man and stuff, kind of what's life going to be like in virtual reality. I remember cycling to Clydebank Shopping Centre to have a VR helmet put on my head and to experience what that was. So we were kind of desperate to see what was coming. And yet, you know, you've got this movie, Virtuosity. I mean, the year, I'm just checking the year, 1995. And they were trying to imagine 1999. You know, that really shouldn't have been too difficult. They had like 4 years and they somehow get absolutely everything wrong. I mean, first of all, Russell Crowe's a policeman and his costume looks like, I'm sure I saw John Inman wearing this in Are You Being Served once. It's got a kind of leather cap and like bright blue, you know, I can't describe what it's like. The clothes, imagine future always like, you know, the kind of imagination of what your costumes are going to be like. And what he is dealing with is artificial intelligence, which is something that you know, I mentioned to you the other day. I'm always kind of like, kids are always saying to me, are you not worried that artificial intelligence will replace you? And when I look at what AI writes, it's incomprehensible gibberish. And I'm like, yes, I could write that. I could definitely write incomprehensible gibberish, and I don't want a machine kind of encroaching on my turf because this is what I do. But in this film, AI is actually Russell Crowe. Russell Crowe is the embodiment of AI. It uploads and downloads whatever Jack the Ripper's history, and he becomes an AI composed of every serial killer who ever lived, and bursts out of AI into our world where he's tracked down by Denzel Washington. And it's one of these films where it's like, how could you get the future so wrong in 1995? They do have video phones, but they're like the size of fridges. Monitors are still the big bucket monitors from about 1995. And for some reason, there's food mixers absolutely everywhere in this film. Like, you keep seeing these kind of Blade Runner-esque kind of like, you know, pile up sort of kind of street kind of like cafes and things like that, and like strange things going on. And there's piles of food mixers. I don't know, they must just have had them like sitting around the set. And meanwhile, Russell Crowe wanders through as an AI, and he's got this wonderful like dialogue. It talks about, oh, the symphony of collision and things like that. And it's just like, this is the internet and artificial reality imagined by people who had absolutely no idea what this thing was going to be like. And now that we've kind of lived through it, at least we can kind of look back on this and find this absolutely kind of ridiculous that we couldn't imagine what the problems were going to be. You know, even in 1995, we didn't really see what the internet was going to do. My theory was that because of the internet allowed people to communicate easily and with anyone, so I thought we would all become friends. I thought that this would reach out between countries and we'd all be caught up in some kind of utopian kind of world where we'd have some other problem to deal with, but we would all be friends outside of our governments. And instead, it worked the other way. It was the monetized hatred, and the idea that you can use the internet to turn people against each other has turned out to be the big money-making thing of it. So it's kind of odd that, you know, they made so many futuristic movies, but none of them actually really nailed that idea of it would be a mass communication that would take place and that we would actually all end up all the worse for it. You know, in a way, it would be easier to deal with, you know, Russell Crowe bursting out of Russell virtual reality than actually deal with what we're going through today. So I think that's why we get from this point, we couldn't see the danger before it arrived, and once the danger arrived, it was almost too late to do anything about it. And that is a kind of, you know, one of the disappointments of growing up, you know, in a generation where we thought we were not racist, and we were looking at the fall of the Berlin Wall, and we were looking at walls coming down and people connecting to each other, and suddenly there was an about turn, and it was around about the time of the internet, and the world changed into a world where building walls was suddenly the cool thing to do. And you know, this is now how we're going to make money, is we're going to turn you against each other. And it's kind of like, you know, maybe there's a kickback against it now, so maybe there is a kind of new hope after all. But it is a kind of like, it's a disappointing thing about life, is that I would say, when I think about what it must be like to be a teenager today, I don't think that they have got a lot of the things going for them that we did at the time. I think that there was more jobs and there was more variety, and there was just, you weren't answerable to the internet all the time. You weren't constantly being distracted and having your name called by this thing. And I guess you can choose how you want to interact with the internet or not. But at the same time, I'm one of these people who thinks that the internet is a big part of what has gone kind of wrong with society, and fixing the internet would actually give us a chance to make a better world.
The long-running BBC television programme, Tomorrow's World, is fondly remembered by those of us who grew up watching it. And it certainly played a huge, if not always reliable, role in shaping our vision of what the future might look like. To explain its legacy, So Disappointed's co-writer and producer, Paul Whitelaw, spoke to TV historian, author, and host of the brilliant Looks Unfamiliar podcast, Tim Worthington.
Tomorrow's World was a very long-running BBC science magazine show, started on BBC One in 1965, where the basic point of it was literally what the title implied. It was inventions, innovations, gadgets that were either just about to be finessed or were awaiting a patent or were in some kind of development or testing. And the emphasis was always on working with it. It never really posited sort of one switch flick cures all solutions. It was devices that might be of benefit to your work, to your everyday life, to your travel. And quite often, I believe it was a little more serious early on. It had more sort of, you know, starchy presenters, for want of a better word. But later on, particularly when you got to the 80s, when you got to the era of presenters like Howard Stapleford and Judith Hamm, they tended to have more of a knowing look. Sometimes things didn't work when demonstrated on air, and they always made a joke out of it. They always seemed to have a bit of a twinkle in their eye, a little sense of mischief, and the idea that maybe sometimes things were being invented for the sake of it, and they never took anything too seriously. I think one example that a lot of people remember from the 80s is when they demonstrated the brand new home entertainment format, the compact disc, Judith Hand said something along the lines of, it'll sound almost as though Boy George is next to you. And immediately, I think this was deliberately badly, they cued in the superimposed sort of life-size cutout of Boy George. And that was the tenor of it, basically. It was just showing you potential improvements. It was actually really, really exciting, particularly when you got to the 80s. Prior to that, it had the theme tune by Johnny Dankworth, which is a great tune, but not very futuristic. And the opening titles were even more analog than analog. It had letters being formed out of bacon and rivets and so on. It gets to the early 80s. They replace it with a theme tune by Richard Denton and Martin Cook, who did a lot of TV themes around that time. And I'm convinced that New Order heard that just after Joy Division had wound up and thought, we should just copy that and nobody will notice. But the problem was that people's demands and expectations of technology changed, and Tomorrow's World became surplus to requirements, really. It was cancelled as long ago as 2003 because there's no need for it anymore. And I think in retrospect, for reasons that do really mean a lot to me, I think it promised more than it delivered.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned there, obviously there were quite a lot of inventions and innovations that didn't become part of commonplace life, like the CD, for example. But it was more, given the amount of years it was on, most of the things introduced on the programme were never seen again, were they? These gizmos. Which I think was more famous for doing that than for actually saying, here's something that is going to change your life.
Oh, absolutely. It always reminds me of, did you ever, there used to be Doctor Who annuals in the 70s that had little to do with Doctor Who itself. They would have John Pertwee or Tom Baker on the cover, and they would be filled up not just with ludicrous tech stories and comic strips, but also with single page features about science that nobody asked for. Yes. And there was always a page. There was always a page of forthcoming inventions, none of which ever happened. I still wish that somehow they got round to that that glue that John Pertwee promised dentists were going to give you to push into fillings yourself without the need for any drilling. And I do remember one of them put forward the revolutionary idea that doctors might be able to record prescriptions onto an audio tape and give them to people. Wow. Yeah, that's the future right there. But yes, Tomorrow's World was quite guilty of that. But that's one of the aspects that I enjoyed of it at the time, the idea that you might find yourself using one of these gizmos and gadgets and you might not. And that's really one of the less explored areas of Feel It Over-Delivered was they didn't anticipate that people's demands were going to be for one thing to do everything for them, which is something I feel quite strongly about. Like, for example, you know, there is this idea, I think, propagated by a lot of the people at the top of the tech chain have never known that thrill of watching something like Tomorrow's World. They've only known the adulation they get for, in inverted commas, inventing something. And they want everyone to gravitate towards the same resource that does everything for them, including thinking for them all at once. And my perspective is, if I want to listen to, say, Tim Buckley, the 60s singer-songwriter, while I'm walking around, I want to do so without being interrupted by WhatsApp groups that I have to be a member of out of politeness and obligation. But it's really, really hard to get a standalone MP3 player now. And yet, had Tomorrow's World lasted just that bit longer, imagine how many features there would have been about the MP3 player.
Oh, absolutely. And podcasts and, you know, what we're doing now, essentially. So yeah, and as you mentioned earlier, certainly by the 80s, it's sort of imperial phase, if you like. The presenters were, they were a bit more irreverent. They were in on the joke. They were sharing that kind of knowledge with the audience that this is a bit mad, but it's a bit fun, really, you know.
I think that was part of where we thought technology was going to go at that stage. The idea that what I suppose were digital solutions in an analog world. It's a bit like if anyone's seen the recent film of the Fantastic Four, the idea that in the early 60s, all of our needs would have been met by, you know, spools of tape and so on. And there was no need for things to go any further. It was sort of founded in that. So people were able to chortle a bit more because it was something that felt within reach. It wasn't high flown. It wasn't wildly futuristic, and you know, it wasn't relayed to you by a robot who walked on very stiltedly and, you know, intoned in an unrealistic robot voice. It was almost in front of you because you saw all of this around all the time, particularly in the 80s. I remember him, especially the racing driver Stirling Moss. I don't know how this happened, but he lived in, quote, an electric house, which is forever being profiled on various TV programs, including Tomorrow's World, where, for example, he fitted a button-operated lift so that if he had a large delivery of, I don't know, sump oil or something, he could move it to the top floor with ease. The show called Micro Live, where it was essentially not just a home computing news and review show, but business computing as well. But they had a very irreverent tone. Oddly, there was one on the iPlayer where one of the reporters is Alan Sugar, who is actually quite funny in it and make some jokes.
What happened?
I could scarcely believe when I saw it. But that was, it was, the irreverence was there because there was excitement and there was joy. And I think that's what we lost along the way. That's what really what Tomorrow's World promised to us that we didn't get, that we don't have now. And that resources that some of us took to like some kind of crazy modem-enabled duck to water, like a lot of the early internet, well, Twitter, for example, have been rerouted away from being a tool that you use to something that shouts at you all the time. And, you know, I don't know about anyone else, but I'm on social media to talk about the banana splits. Give me that back.
I just want that and nothing else. But no, you're absolutely right. Just to finish on, that's a lovely point. It kind of embodied a sense of joy and wonder and optimism that perhaps we've lost a bit, you know, and now, which is a shame.
Absolutely, because if you watch any old editions, even right into the 2000s, there is nothing flashy or serious about it. It's a gaudy BBC set. At one point in the 70s, they just had a sort of white void like you would have seen on Play School and Blue Peter, with the presenters just sort of seemingly looming out of the ether and demonstrating a new kind of carjack or whatever. And it was an entertainment show, and that's the point. It wasn't suggesting anything other than that, for the most part. I mean, they did talk about things like medical advances, but much of the content was in some way it would entertain us, whether that was directly providing entertainment or entertaining you by making part of your job a bit more palatable, a bit less boring. And where is that entertainment now? I mean, I don't want to be completely without hope, because one thing I can say is that one of my areas of expertise is recovery of old TV, old lost film and so on. And in recent years, I mean, well, for example, on one of the Doctor Who Blu-rays, there is a Tomorrow's World from 1992, where they explain how a John Pertwee Doctor Who story that had been wiped existed as a black and white film print and the colour off a video recording. And there's a fantastic feature on how they combined the two, basically by distorting and stretching the picture. But more recently, and these would have been covered on Tomorrow's World, again, Doctor Who related, but people discovered how to extract the colour from black and white film prints of programmes that were made in colour. But also, more recently, somebody has recovered the visuals from a lost Morecambe and Wise show that was basically liquid in the can by using a new X-ray process, with the added benefit that there's a safe way of testing it for medical applications. And that is... It sounds ridiculous saying this because those are already in the past, but that is the future to me. That is what Tomorrow's World promised me, and that is what I don't have.
"30 seconds to give us your music 2000. Good luck.
Thanks, Tim. Thim. Over now to our Gen Z correspondent, Sprite Kirkwood, who, as always, will speak on behalf of every single young person in the world. This time around, Sprite takes us into Tomorrowland. So, Sprite, throughout this episode, we've been talking about very UK-centric visions of a utopian future.
Mm-hmm.
Things like Tomorrow's World. Things that maybe our American listeners and listeners around the world, they won't recognise. But you know rather a lot about a vision of the future that they might recognise. What is that?
That would be Tomorrowland. Tomorrowland is a section of the theme park Disneyland and Disney World, which are located all around the world, based on a vision of the future. But now, it was one of the later additions to Walt Disney's original plans for the first Disneyland park in Anaheim, California. It was slated to open at the park later than the actual opening day of Disneyland in 1955, but was pushed up due to capacity concerns at the park, not knowing how many people might actually show up on opening day. Which led it to be a very half-baked land when it originally opened, but as the years went on and it found its footing, it was much more fleshed out and seemed to have a mainstay in the park. So
it was a coherent, was it a destination for people going to the Disney parks? Would you go to the Disney parks because you wanted to go to Tomorrowland?
I would not say so. At the time when it first opened, there wasn't any Space Mountain, there wasn't Buzz Lightyear, there wasn't Stitch's Great Escape. There wasn't any of the big rides that you go to Tomorrowland for nowadays.
Yeah.
When Tomorrowland first opened back in 1955, it was a bit of a mini World's Fair where Disney reached out to the major tech companies of the world and the electronics, the new innovators in post-war America, asking, hey, do you want to exhibit your new technology at Disneyland? And a lot of them did say yes. There was such amazing exhibits as the American Dairy Milk Bar, where you could get a glass of milk and not much else.
Whoa.
There was the There was the bathroom of the future, where everything was automated and your toilet cleaned itself. There was the plastic house as well. These are all real Tomorrowland attractions.
Wow.
And as well as this, one of the main attractions that brought people into the land, maybe giving them a wrong impression of magic in the future and space travel, was a large, I think 70-foot tall rocket, which was in fact a real decommissioned Wernher von Braun rocket from World War II. Tomorrowland, when it first opened, it was impressive for about 20% of the audience. Disneyland was, at the time, not entirely a theme park. It was meant to be a place where adults and children could both play and have fun. That's the famous speech by Walt Disney.
Before our preview of Tomorrowland, I'd like to read these few words of dedication. A vista into a world of wondrous ideas, signifying man's achievement, a step into the future, with predictions of constructive things to come. Tomorrow offers new frontiers in science, adventure, and ideals, the atomic age, the challenge of outer space, and the hope for a peaceful and unified world.
So Tomorrowland, what kind of vision of the future did Tomorrowland have?
Tomorrowland had the very post-war America optimistic vision of the future. It's plastic and bright colours and Coca-Cola and all that. So it's very space age, very 1950s, 1960s, that kind of aesthetic.
So how has Tomorrowland aged?
Not well. Don't get me wrong, Tomorrowland is still a fantastic part of a Disneyland park, and people would be mad if Tomorrowland wasn't there. It's an incredible place. But one thing that Walt Disney realised quite quickly was that the future keeps catching up.
Oh.
And this...
Does that mean that the visions of the future in Tomorrowland were accurate?
Sometimes, yes. But at the exact same time, it kind of just meant that visions of the future kept changing, or the future that they were talking about in hypotheticals in the 50s and 60s were eventually reality by the 80s and 90s. Something that's been a hypothetical for ages was, like, video calls. Like, as soon as the telephone came out, it was, what if we could have a video with it? What if we could see the person we were having a phone call with? Something that happened was that they realised that unless these exhibits had constant maintenance, unless they were changing every month or so, they wouldn't be able to sustain it. And so this creates something called the Tomorrowland problem, where instead of a future being so far off and just not happening, this is the exact opposite. This is the future that we think about coming to reality. If you look back at old science fiction shows or science fiction movies, you'll see technology that at the time they viewed as impossible, but now is just something that we have every day. The tricorders in Star Trek, that's just the modern day cell phone. Ever since the 60s and the 70s, when Walt Disney realized the unsustainability of constantly updating a massive exhibit of Tomorrowland, they kind of shifted to a much more silly idea of the future. No longer what are the big tech companies of today engineering for the masses of America. Much more, let's go to Mars and get aliens and stuff.
What are they getting the aliens to do?
Scary stuff.
The aliens are doing scary stuff.
Alien Encounter Extreme is, I think, the name of the attraction. It was a walk-through attraction where there's like an alien breaking out and it attacks the people in the audience. It was really scary.
Oh.
That was 90s though, and then it was too scary and then they replaced it with Stitch.
Oh, which is not scary at all.
Yeah. After the kind of World's Fair idea had died down amongst the people of Disney and they instead started to focus on a much more fantastical idea of the future, it kind of started to slow down the panic around Tomorrowland, and the focus began to shift away from science, away from engineering, to fun and silliness. So the Tomorrowland of today, the version of the land which is currently at the parks, mainly Magic Kingdom in Florida, is a odd mix of different eras' ideas of the future. There is lots of elements which are sleek and very modern and minimalist and futuristic to today's standards. But if you venture a little bit into the land, you'll find a Space Mountain with very 90s aesthetics and that early Spy Kids looking CGI in the queue lines. And you'll also find a restaurant with an animatronic alien playing the synthesizer who looks a lot like Alf.
So it's a mixture of real futurism mixed with a kind of a retro.
Yes, it's nowadays the senses of futurism and the ideas of what the future might actually look like have kind of been moved to Epcot, the sister park to Magic Kingdom in Florida. That's kind of the sciencey, what does the future hold for us, park of Disney World today. But even then, it's focusing much less on Spaceship Earth and the missions to Mars and more on Moana and Guardians of the Galaxy nowadays. The Tomorrowland problem has plagued the Disney parks across the world, but one park that has been able to fix this Tomorrowland problem is Disneyland Paris with Discoveryland. Now, Discoveryland is a version of Tomorrowland. It is its own land. It has a Space Mountain, it has the Astro Spinners, it has like a retro-futuristic 60s car ride. But one of the things that it's changed is that instead of being based on some hypothetical future made up by the designers, it is instead based on French author Jules Verne, whose works were some of the earliest science fiction writings. So 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Around the World in 80 Days, A Journey to the Center of the Earth. The Space Mountain in Paris is based on his book A Trip to the Moon, which had a bunch of Americans shooting a gun at the moon, because what else would Americans do? Sorry, Americans. Placing Tomorrowland in the past, that is the only way that they've been able to solve the Tomorrowland problem.
Here's David Myers again.
This is really personal for me, and it's not really anything to do with psychology. It's to do with something I thought about when I was doing an essay on the book 1984 for my higher English. That book is one of the greatest pieces of literature ever, but it was a warning. And my essay question was about, and it was written in 1994, this essay for me, to what extent has George Orwell's vision of the future come true?
Wow.
And even by then, there was this surveillance state in the UK. There was a lot of concern about the amount of CCTV that there was. Now, I think that vision of the future has come to pass in so many more ways than were even possible back then. So surveillance is everywhere. So not only with CCTV, number plate recognition, we've got phones that track us, we've got watches that track us, we've got devices in our homes that listen to us, they know what we do, they know where we go, we know how long we're spending there. Everything is tracked and analysed and
modified. We have become,
yeah,
our data has become a commodity.
Yes. Another sort of aspect of 1984 that's very real is the erosion of language. Words are taking on new or having completely distorted meanings. There's an increasing number of neologisms, which are basically just newspeak. And if you think about YOLO, LOL, like the number of times people have just said LOL instead of actually laughing. And the whole point of newspeak was that it was there to divert the brain's attention from providing an emotional response to anything. So the population were being blunted. We are being blunted by having our expression limited.
the future. It really ain't what it used to be. Let's wrap things up now with a few more thoughts from myself and film critic Eddie Harrison. Eddie, do you think there are any current films or TV shows, anything online or on social media, that still suggest we'll somehow be okay eventually?
Maybe I'm just having a good experience of it, but I think was it last year, the year before, the list asked me for my kind of moment of the year. And I said that after the false dawn of Threads, it was kind of the creation of Blue Sky. And I saw somebody in Blue Sky today just posted a picture of a beautiful garden and said, you know, this is what Blue Sky is to me. This is what I get from this place. I get that there may be bots. I get that there may be people on the periphery of it. But in general, it is a kind of friendly, almost utopian place where, you know, you can post and say things and not expect to be immediately like torn apart by complete strangers. And, you know, I get the, you know, social media is never going to work for everybody and etc. But I would say there's quite a healthy community on there. Obviously, I'm you know, heady with Mark Hamill liking something that I posted, a picture of my cat, and a comment about the Hungarian elections. And, you know, that idea that, you know, Luke Skywalker liked my cat's comment about the Hungarian election, to me, is the internet in a microcosm. You know, that is the kind of the weird juxtaposition that you can get from it. But that is the good side of the internet. And what we have learned to do is channel out the rest of it. So we don't care what goes on in Twitter or Fox News or et cetera, other than for kind of shock value. But that kind of ending up in a bubble, it's like, you know, that a utopia is fine, but if it's only a utopia for you, is it really worth having? And I think that finding other like-minded people is a big deal. And I think that at the moment, it's probably about to turn into a hellscape, who knows. But Blue Sky is kind of, I'm finding like-minded people on there, and there seems to be a kind of movement. And oddly, it's not also, I would say that's not a very political one, although politicians have now kind of joined into it. But also it's a great resource. It's just, it does what Reddit does as well, which is it kind of links people together. You know, I saw a thing on Reddit of people who are interested in unfangling balls of string. And that they, did you see this?
And they're joined with people who have really fankled up balls of string, and I think that's so beautiful.
And so if you've got a problem with a really fankled up ball of string, you can find somebody who would like nothing more than to unfankle it. And I would say that that is the best thing about social media in a nutshell, is just finding somebody a bit like, you know, the kind of Rabsy Nesbitt joke about when he's in Spain and he's like shouting across and he sees a version of himself shouting back, and the kind of realization that, oh, there's somebody in Canada who thinks exactly the same as me. There's somebody in New Zealand who feels the same about Aaron Taylor Johnson as I do. You know, it's kind of like finding these connections with people, and that's kind of what I thought the internet was going to be about back in 1999. I've got recollection of going to see The Saint, Val Kilmer version, of the kind of Simon Templar, you know, character. And that was the first time I'd seen, he had in the boot of his car, which I think was a Volvo, he had a bag, and in that bag was a computer, and with the computer was a kind of magic kind of phone, I think, called a modem. And what you could do is you could set up your computer anywhere and you could send messages to anyone all around the world on it. I remember seeing this gadget and thinking, wow, that is amazing. I want that. That is, you know, there's an interesting debate going back to something we were saying earlier about, do James Bond films dictate car design, or do car designers dictate James Bond films? And it's been proved to be a mixture of the two, that things are put in fancifully in a James Bond film and car designer go, oh, that looks super cool, we're going to do that for real. And vice versa, it's like, you know, there's things that car designers do in the Bond, but oh, that looks cool, we'll put that into the James Bond film. These things kind of feed off each other. And I think that it's that kind of notion of connection, but not corruption. The idea that nobody is making money from this. You know, I was writing the other day, I don't know if I've published it yet, just about, I met somebody who works for YouTube, who said, anything that you're not paying for on the internet, you are the product that is being
Yes,
sold.
you are a
And
commodity.
that's, you know, I think that that is something that young people probably should kind of wake up to, the idea that they are being bought and sold in a community because they're using something that appears to be free, like a mail service or whatever it might be. But actually, you know, they can change things by how they behave online and what sites they go to, and that they don't just have to consume a bit of everything to stay up to date, but they can pick and choose, and they can authenticate where their news is coming from and work out. It's not just about how you get the information, but if you understand it and where you understand it coming from. And I think that, you know, these are the challenges that we didn't see coming. You know, if you look at the kind of movies in the late 90s and whatever, they don't really kind of get a good grip. The Matrix is one of the, it's got a real, you know, unfortunately now quite sinister, the kind of whole red pill, blue pill thing has been co-opted into
Yes.
something kind of quite different, you know. But The Matrix had this kind of cynicism about, we're gonna, this is going somewhere bad, you know, and you as an individual will have to kind of fight against it. And I think that if we can, you know, maybe steal that back from the kind of the right wing and say, actually, The Matrix did have that, walk that line of kind of saying, you know, you want to watch out for the future because you could just be a brain in a jar in a farm somewhere, and that would be the limit of who you were. And unless you wake up to it, something, and then it became something else. And, you know, I don't want to go into what went wrong with the Matrix, because that would be a so disappointing. That would be a, the Matrix, my goodness, people, that would just seemed like the best thing ever until it turned into a whole pile of nonsense.
I think I'm just aching for a candy-coloured positive vision of the future, and I just don't think we have that anymore.
Yeah, I don't think that we are in a good place right now. And, you know, I think that identifying what the source of it, you know, we're not actually blaming the internet. We're blaming the people who have been in charge or put in charge of things on the internet and have kind of let society down, I would say, by, you know, being kind of trusted with a great responsibility and actually using it as a tool for division and to, you know, cause unhappiness and to cause people to divide and separate. And, you know, it didn't have to be like that. And I think the, you know, you can look at online things like Blue Sky and say there are pockets of resistance to the idea of this kind of entropy of everything getting worse.
Yes.
And we want to believe that that can be a thing moving forward, that, you know, there, I'm sure people said in the 70s, oh, you know, kids are too full of TV and music, you know, this is ridiculous. You know, I'm sure people said in the 90s, oh, you know, well, goodness knows what people said in the 90s, as they failed to grasp, you know, this is what I do think. You know, I remember going to the Millennium Dome, which is another massive disappointment. And, you know, that vision of the future, which was just like, you know, Peter Gabriel kind of flute music, and, you know, I don't know, just stuff that was not going to be anything to do with what we, you know, it was all kind of mystical and wow, gosh, look how far we've come. And what we didn't realize, that there was like an absolute, you know, train coming straight towards us in the form of something that would accelerate negative feeling towards each other in a way that we had never seen before. So scary times, but, you know, we've got to believe that we're going to come out on the other side. We're so disappointed, but we're going to be so happy when we get it all sorted.
We're living in the future, chaps. We're living in the future, and it's not very nice. We said that at the start of the episode. We're living in dystopia. We're living on an ever-warming planet, an ever more right-leaning planet. A planet where our thoughts, our beliefs, our needs are being scraped, mined, sold to somebody richer than anybody should ever be. And I think we've stopped thinking about the future because it feels so very bleak. But there is something that we can do. We can believe. And there are things worth believing in.
And the first thing that I think is worth believing in is science. Believe science. The scientists have been screaming at us for decades that we needed to do something about the planet. Carl Sagan was talking about this when I was young, before I was even born, and I am not young anymore. We need to listen to the scientists, and we need to do what they are telling us to do, and we need to stop hanging all of the pressure of the world onto individual shoulders. Greta Thunberg has done her bit. Now it's our turn. It is our turn to take on the personal responsibility for changing the world. You and I have a voice. We get to use that voice to make a change for the better. Find out what you can do to make your future better, even if it's a tiny little thing. Even if it's just emailing your elected representative and ask them what they're going to do about something which is itching your brain. Do it today. It'll take you 5 minutes. I want you to look around in your own little tiny corner of the world and think, how do I make this better? Even if it's you in the house with your cat or your hamster or your dog or your, I don't know, your pet spider called Trevor. Figure out what you could do to make life better for you and Trevor, and do it. Make your own future better. That will have ripples that move out into the vast ocean of humanity. Maybe we should talk about the future being better. Maybe we should believe in utopia again. We have already managed to slow down global warming. We have done that by making changes. We fixed the hole in the ozone layer. We have essentially cured cervical cancer with a vaccine. I'm sorry this is such a rant, but it's something that I believe in so strongly, that we individually can make a change. So put on your own cape, believe in your own superpowers, and take action today. Because the future is now. And together, we're going to make it a little less disappointing. So Disappointed was written by Paul Whitelaw and edited by Wendy Jordan. It was produced by Paul and by me. We would like to thank our amazing guests, David Myers, Tim Worthington, Eddie Harrison, and Sprite Kirkwood. If you have any ideas for the podcast, come and track us down on social media. We're on Blue Sky and we're on Instagram. We'd like to thank our listeners all over the world for supporting us. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please consider reviewing and rating the podcast. That's how we get it out to more people. Let people know about So Disappointed and how you're not so disappointed. We'll be back next month, and we'll be talking about the establishment and how disappointing it is when our heroes, who we thought were sticking it to the man, suddenly become part of the machine.
I am so disappointed in you.
Va-vu-va! Va! Four!